Heading to CBC? Make sure to stop by booth 1989 to chat with the Brewbound team, check out our live podcast recordings, and find out about Brewbound's upcoming events. Have news to submit ahead of the show? Head to brewbound.com/submitnews to let us know about your latest updates.
Welcome back to the Brewbound podcast. This is Justin Kendall, the editor of Brewbound, and I'm joined in the Brewbound podcast studio by Jess Infante. Jess, it's been a wild week. I guess last week was a wild week of news. You did some coverage of Boston Beer's earnings. It was pretty big.
Yeah, record-breaking quarter for them, which I think had to have been a record-breaking year.
$1.25 billion with a B.
With a B.
In revenue last year. That is on the back of Truly and Twisted Tea and some Dogfish at the end there.
A little bit of Dogfish. Yeah, mostly all Truly, yeah, which is good for those guys.
Triple-digit growth for Truly. And yet, Wall Street wasn't too pleased.
No, Wall Street was really not all that pleased about it. That was really interesting to listen to all of the analyst questions at the end of that conference call, because all of that is most, well, not all, but a lot of that is happening at contract breweries, which is just a lot more expensive.
Yeah, that seems to be a big drag on their gross margin. So it's been a rougher go for them, I guess, in terms of profitability.
Yeah, so I think it's just, I don't know, man. I wouldn't sneeze at $1.25 billion. That's crazy.
No, and they've got very high like depletions growth. But just keeping up with that Truly demand has really been an issue for them. And that's what's sort of pulling down that gross margin.
Right. And it seems like it's going to continue until we really know where seltzer volume demand is going to settle out.
As a nerd, I'm excited to see their supply chain like reevaluation and what they're going to do.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to watch.
Well, that wasn't the only news of last week. We had a couple of big like people moves. The biggest probably being Lagunitas CEO Maria Stipp stepping down, and she will be replaced by Dennis Peake, who was the GM of Heineken's Canadian business. As our listeners know, Lagunitas fully owned by Heineken International. This is kind of, from an outsider, it kind of looks like, you know, they're bringing in their own guy finally to sit in the chair.
The question is, how can he maintain Lagunitas' culture? They recently launched a new global marketing campaign that's really centers on Petaluma and the vibe and the culture there. They have a whole online video that's just about this one orange couch from, you know, the early days that I'm sure, you know, Tony dragged into the brewery himself. So we're in this phase where these smaller breweries that come up and really create their own culture. And if you're Lagunitas, a lot of that is almost counterculture driven. But when you get bought by this very big international brewer, how do you strike the balance and how do you keep your own identity?
You got to keep the couch.
You have to keep the couch.
Comes down to dogs and couches and that. Well, again, this is a, we'll see what happens, you know, now.
Yeah, I mean,
situation.
We should have this conversation in 6 months.
6 months, a year, who knows? And finally, Neil Stewart, the VP of marketing for Deschutes Brewery, is taking on the top sales role as well. So he's going to have a lot on his plate.
A lot on his plate. And having worked in a marketing department, and it's funny to me that, you know, those two, everybody's got the same goal, but sometimes those two factions can kind of war with each other a little bit based on, you know, tactics and goals and opinions. So
what did Rick James say? Unity. I think that's what it is. You got to bring unity.
Yes. Yes, you absolutely do.
Yeah. Well, lots of changes in the industry. It's moving fast. And this week's featured interview will deal with a lot of business changes too. Ironheart Canning is one of the biggest mobile canners in the business. The New England-based mobile canning company works with hundreds of beer companies on the East Coast, and they're moving into the Midwest as well. And increasingly, some of those businesses that they're working with are outside of the beer industry, or they're beer companies that are making products such as hard seltzer, canned wine, canned cocktails, whatever it may be. So this week, we're going to talk to Tyler Willey, the founder and CEO of Ironheart. Heads up, this interview was recorded before a deal went down last week in which Ironheart acquired Michigan Mobile Canning. So Tyler's going to talk a little bit about how they aren't really looking to expand into other markets. Well, they must have hit a point where they felt comfortable enough to expand into other markets. So he's going to talk about M&A. He's going to talk about the difficulties of running a mobile canning business. He's going to talk about their Beyond Beer business and a whole lot more. So here's Tyler Willey. This is Justin Kendall for the Brewbound Podcast, and I'm here in the Brewbound Podcast studio in Watertown, Massachusetts, with Tyler Willey, the founder and CEO of Ironheart Canning. So before we get started here, for the people who may not be familiar with Ironheart Canning, give them a little bit of background on, you know, who you are and what Ironheart does.
Sure. So firstly, Ironheart is a mobile canning company. We don't do any production ourselves. All we do is packaging, and we handle finished product from a customer at their facility. So we bring all of our equipment loaded into trucks. We have box trucks that everything is done straight lined, drive it to the customer's facility, unload all of our equipment, bring it into the facility as close to the finishing tanks as possible, drain their tanks, package up their cans, clean our equipment, load the trucks, and take our, you know, and take ourselves home. And we leave all the product at the facility itself. So we don't transport any finished product. We are strictly just a packager and provide that level. Basically, the things that we provide are obviously the equipment that is, it's expensive for breweries to buy. But really, when I talk about Ironheart and what we bring to the table, it's the expertise. Packaging is not easy, especially canning at a small scale. The equipment doesn't run itself. And if you want to maximize the quality, production efficiency, it's very difficult. It takes a lot of expertise and know-how. And that's what we really bring to the table. That's what we focus on as a company.
And you're the largest mobile canner in the U.S.?
We are.
Yep. And talk about the area, because I believe you guys stretch all the way down the East Coast. You do the entire East Coast and then pretty much the entire South, right?
Yep. So we say we go Maine to Miami, out to the Mississippi. So that's our coverage area. And for the most part, we can hit any area within that footprint. So out West, we don't cover all the way up and down the Mississippi, but we cover out to Ohio, down through Tennessee, through Alabama, and then down towards Florida. But how we have our structure laid out is, even though we cover that much of an area, we're super local. We're a very local company. We have 23 warehouses over that footprint. So really within that whole geography, we are 2 to 3 hours from any potential customer, bar a few areas such as Charleston, where we're about 4 hours from Charleston and do a lot of work. But we're very local. All of our teams are local. It's managed locally. So we're really integrated with all of the craft scene across that footprint and, are able to really be a part of the local community everywhere we are.
So how many clients do you guys work with?
It fluctuates, but we're somewhere between 450 to 500 breweries and cideries, and we're really getting into a lot of wine now and a lot of non-alcoholic craft beverages as well.
Yeah, it's really taken off. So I was curious, I guess, how the explosion of these sort of beyond beer products, you know, people are expanding their portfolios. They're looking to seltzer. They're looking to canned cocktails. They're looking to cider. They're looking to any number of other products for growth. So you guys provide service for that as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Traditionally, we were 100% beer and a little bit of cider as well as we grew. But, you know, I would actually envision Ironheart at some point being maybe even close to 50-50 beer and kind of all other. And
would you say it is now?
We're probably still about 80% beer.
Yeah,
I would say. I kind of put beer and cider together because they're very similar. The facilities are very similar. I mean, I'd say, you know, a craft cidery is just very similar in profile and customer base to a craft brewery. So I kind of put those two together, but probably about 80% beer and cider right now. But it's that gap is shrinking every year as we go quickly, as wine starts really ramping up. And you really call it kind of craft beverages in general. Craft coffee, craft cocktails. We're doing a ton of ready-to-drink cocktails now. There's more craft distilleries start opening up, you know, craft energy drinks. And obviously craft seltzers are getting huge right now, but craft CBD-infused seltzer drinks just taking off. So really craft everything aside from beer, is just exploding, and it's all going into cans right now.
Let's take a step back here for a second, because I'm curious to know how you ended up getting into the business. What sort of drew you in?
Yeah, absolutely. I was planning to open a brewery myself, and had been in plans to open my own brewery for quite a while. I live in Norwalk, Connecticut, and was planning to open a brewery in Norwalk. It's a great spot if you look at kind of do the you know, the layout of consumer base and breweries in the state, especially let's say 10 years ago when there was very little craft breweries in Connecticut. It's kind of a hole in the system right off 95. A lot of consumers there, a lot of people commuting. So it's a great spot, and been a home brewer since I was a junior in college. So very avid about brewing and just love fermentation, huge kombucha maker and things like that. So I was really planning to open a brewery, got pretty far down the path, and then actually came across, I wasn't the first person to do mobile canning. There were some early adopters ahead of me on the West Coast, and came across their services out there, and just kind of a light bulb went off. And at the time, I think there were about 3,500 breweries. We're talking, you know, 7 years ago. Now there's more than double that in the country. You know, I was just thinking to myself, man, there's brewery opening every day with a lot of very talented people making beer. Do I really want to be competing against these people or working with them? And, you know, it seemed like the cans were really starting to take off on the West Coast at the time. There was nothing here on the East Coast. There were no cans in craft really on the East Coast at all. And it seemed like a fantastic service. And I flew out to Colorado, checked out the operation out there, and put a deposit on a canning line in about 2 weeks. Just completely threw my brewery plans in the trash.
just trashed them all together. Huh?
Yeah. After a couple of years of writing a business plan and about faced in about 2 weeks.
Any looking back on that?
It's been a tough couple of years, so I don't know if I'd ever want to relive the last couple of years, but I don't think so, because, you know, we've obviously been very successful at what we're doing. I think we have a really huge impact to our economy, to the customers that we work with. You know, all the customers that we work with grow exponentially once we start working with them, hire a lot of employees. We've gone from one employee myself to 150 employees in 6 years, and I, you know, have no regrets about that whatsoever.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And now you've got, what, 50 lines?
50. We just bought our 50th.
Malt Europe Malting Company is North American proud with premium grains from field to flavor. Our selections include base, specialty, and distillers malt varieties. Stop by our booth, 2143, at the Craft Brewers Conference in Vegas. Does your brewing software suck? We've heard it from thousands of brewers. Connect with Ollie today, and we'll buy out your current contract and hook you up with brewing software that doesn't suck. Visit booth 1685 at CBC or hit getollie.com/pod.
How many customers can a single line service?
So we do one canning run a day for the most part is kind of a standard. So there are some opportunities where we'll have, you know, some breweries that are located close to each other, and we'll be able to coordinate. Let's say if they're very small runs, like, you know, 10, 15 barrel runs, we'll be able to coordinate and schedule that correctly. But logistically, it's very difficult to try to make that happen when you're continually doing more than one job a day. So we're always one job a day. So, you know, you figure roughly around 20 working days in a month. So for the most part, you know, each canning line can do about 20, you know, 20 canning jobs in a month.
Who are the type of brewers you're looking for? Are they big brewers? Are they small brewers? Like, what size of brewer is the typical Ironheart client?
Great question. So as you would think about us, you'd think about, you know, smaller breweries that can't afford packaging, don't have a lot of space, and, you know, might not be canning often, which is absolutely true. You know, we definitely fit into that size customer. But we also, you'd be surprised at the level of bigger breweries, regional breweries that we work with and have worked with over the years. You know, firstly, because, you know, space may be limited in their facility. They may be fully dedicated to bottling or not really launching much canning. And for a bigger brewery, for them to jump into cans, they may need to invest not just in canning lines that we bring, which are Wild Goose machines that cost a couple $100,000. They're looking at a, you know, million, 5 million plus investment for them to dive into cans. So actually the foundation of Ironheart, what's helped us grow so much, is actually the much bigger breweries that we work with and do a tremendous amount of volume with because of those constraints. And we'll typically actually work with them for a really long period of time before they make that full commitment to a huge canning line to actually support their their future needs. So they've actually been the bigger customers. Ironheart have actually been the bigger, probably more regional breweries from a, if you want to look at it, you know, percentage-wise, we say 500 customers. The majority of those customers are typically made up by smaller, more, you know, obviously more local breweries. But from a volume perspective, our volume is greatly outweighed by some of our much larger customers that do a lot more volume, a lot more regularly.
So how does the planning work for Ironheart? Are you getting sort of projections at the start of the year? And do you work on like a contract basis? Like we're going to work for 12 months or we're going to work. How does that sort of work out for you guys?
Yeah,
is it job to job? Is it, how does that work?
That's a great question. We work on partnerships. You know, I started Ironheart with myself in a truck and it's a handshake business. The brewing industry is very much a handshake industry. And we're still very much like that as much as we've grown. And we want to be partners with our customers. We want to be partners with the breweries that we work with because we want to be their infrastructure that they can rely upon. And as long as we're adding the value, we don't need a contract. We don't need any security other than we know that we're providing a greater value than they could provide themselves. And we're providing that added value to them that they're going to continue providing. Eventually, they'll outgrow us or find some other way to package their beer, whether it's contracting somewhere else or something like that. But for the most part, we work on partnership basis. And you know, we typically, volumes, especially for our brewery customers, are typically pretty regular and usually scale over time. So if we're starting at a new brewery that we're working with that's maybe, you know, a 30 or 40 barrel canning job once a month, you know, we know that it'll continue once a month and then maybe it'll scale to every 3 weeks and then every 2 weeks and then every week over time. And we're able to work with them, project that out. And we have very regular interactions with our customers. It's a big part of our business. We want to be the partners. So we focus really heavily on being that voice for them to bounce things off of about building for the future and scaling. So we try really hard to know the volume projections and the needs of our customer base. Because one of the biggest things for us is our schedule. Our schedule is our Bible. You know, if we're at a job on Monday, we have another job scheduled on Tuesday. If something goes wrong with that job on Monday, we have to finish. We have to get to the next job the next day. So it's very important for us to really understand the trajectories of our customers so we can make sure that we're satisfying their needs as they grow.
And how do you work that when, you know, how do those conversations go when one of your partners is sort of graduating from Ironheart and investing in their own canning line?
Yeah, absolutely. We work with them. That's one of the best points because at that point, we've typically had a really great long relationship with them. And by the point that somebody really graduates to their kind of their own equipment, usually they're doing a lot of volume. And so we're, you know, really happy at that point. We work with them all the way to the end. Obviously, we want to continue work with them as long as possible, but we work with them. And you know, in a lot of cases, we've actually stayed on to actually even train our customers in their own line because, like I said in the beginning, the value that we bring isn't, in my opinion, the capital, the equipment that we're bringing. It's the expertise and the quality of the finished product. And all of these canning lines at this level are manually, they're operator-driven canning lines. And we've seen it time and time again when we stop canning for a brewery, their quality takes a hit. Dissolved oxygen levels go through the roof. Shelf life goes way down. So that's the last thing we want to see happen to the partners that we work with. And, you know, we do everything we can to make that transition.
It's pretty altruistic to do that when you're, you know, sort of losing a customer at that point.
Sure. And, you know, there's a life cycle to this business. You know, turning customers is a part of what we do. And there's some customers that we work with that are indefinite for various reasons, but there are others that we know are going to have an end to it. As we've kind of grown through the years as well, we've been able to kind of get ourselves into a point of open-ended capacity. So, you know, from a point of needing a capacity and outgrowing us from a capacity perspective, it's really almost stepping out of the daily capacity that we can offer, because at this point we do things like all the way up to renting and permanently placing canning lines in some breweries, and actually just canning line doesn't move. We go in there, operate it every day, but they're maintaining us because they know they have a locked in quality and a locked in premium package that's coming off, you know, off the canning line every day. And, you know, they'd rather continue with us as opposed to bringing that in house.
That's got to be the best case scenario for you.
Absolutely. Yeah. Best case scenario for sure.
You're not moving the line. You're just leaving it in one place and just, it's like being an employee of the brewery at that point.
Yeah, absolutely. For our staff as well. I mean, typical daily job for us, you know, from a mobile perspective, I mean, we're 12 to 15 hour days mm-hmm. on the regular. And Yeah. And when we can have a line that's kind of parked and permanent, we can do much more volume, much shorter period of time. Obviously there's no driving and setup.
About how many of those do you have?
We have, I would say probably 10 to 12 right now parked.
Yeah. So like a fifth of your business is just static.
Yep.
That's awesome. Is the demand there to sort of fill in once somebody does graduate?
Yeah, that's what we try to. We have a talented sales team that's out there, you know, every day. And I think that's where, I don't think we've seen a downturn in new breweries coming on at this point, but we know that that point might happen at some point where we kind of get saturated with new potential breweries in the geography that we're working on. But we're seeing the great new verticals in the wine market, ready to drink cocktails, you know, energy drinks and seltzers and CBD. So at this point, it's just, you know, we're bringing on a lot more customers than we're losing as we go.
So are those breweries or are those dedicated companies to those particular segments?
As far as kind of the different
yeah,
products?
Is it like a brewery doing canned wine? Is it a brewery doing canned cocktails? Is it, you know, a brewery doing hard seltzer? Are these dedicated companies to these segments?
Yeah, that's a great question because it actually is. It is how the brewing industry is a lot different than every other type of consumed liquid in this country because every single brewery, typically, I mean, there's obviously contract breweries out there, but for the most part, every brewery has their own brick and mortar and mm-hmm. they do all their production there and that's where they do their volume. That's where they sell it of. When you get to all the other products, it's not true, you know, and especially when you get to anything in the kind of the non-alcoholic world, they're more brands than they are actual facilities and producers. So all of like anything with a non-alcoholic, anything, and even with wine and ready-to-drink cocktails, a lot of that is being done at central co-packers. And so the brand itself is only a brand and they're not doing any of the production mm-hmm. itself. So what we've actually done is we have actually a pretty expansive network of co-packers that we've really partnered with in a very deep way. And these are all places that we typically have a line for the most part parked there. Where we can feed these type of customers too that don't have their own facility. Obviously, you have that in the beer world, so we do have some beer co-packers that we work with. And there are some breweries that can do other things other than beer as well, but licensing gets a little difficult for them. So for the most part, we're sending a lot of this other stuff, including wine, to centralized co-packers. When you look at wine, for instance, I mean, obviously, most wineries have their own winery, but you know, from a producer's perspective on wine, it's also different than a brewery because you're in the brewery world, you brew a batch of beer, it's ready in for the most part 2-3 weeks. And so you can continue brewing batches of beer. For wine, you're getting all your liquid at one time, you know, and there's harvest and there's crush. And then you have to plan your production for the whole next year. So for a winery, you might only do 1 or 2 canning runs for the year, as opposed to the brewery where you're there every month or every other week or something like that. Mm-hmm. So it's a lot different from that perspective. And that's why it's all kind of all funneled to more central co-packers.
When one of your clients, one of their businesses just skyrocketing, like you see them sort of hit they're on the rocket ship. How do you evolve that, you know, and they're coming to you asking for, they have demands for, you know, more canning.
Absolutely.
How do you meet those needs?
Definitely. We try to stay as flexible and nimble as possible. And it's one of the reasons why we have so many warehouses so close together. We basically have a warehouse almost every 3 hours of drive time up and down the East Coast, and we stay small and nimble, and we don't operate at max capacity for that exact reason. We want to be looked at as the partner for all of our customers to satisfy their needs when they need it and be flexible to be able to accommodate that. So we intentionally operate lower than our maximum capacity so that we're able to actually absorb very short-term pops in volume. And it does happen, and it happens a lot. Hey, I just landed this account at Kroger's. I got a 10,000 case order I got to get done within the next 3 weeks. How can we do this? And it happens all the time. And it's why we operate with flexibility built in to be able to accommodate that, because we know one of the biggest things that us as a company cannot offer our customers is the fact that canning line is sitting there for the most part that they can utilize whenever they want for whatever volumes they want. And so we do everything we can to try to make that happen and to try to accommodate that level of flexibility, because that is more of our Achilles heel with our customers than anything, is that level of flexibility. And you know, we'll never get there to that point of mm-hmm. being able to offer unlimited flexibility, but we try very hard to keep a lot of open-ended scheduling, a lot of free days. So if you say, hey, something happened, I was going to bottle this batch or keg this batch, I decided to can it when's the next time you can get here? Typically, we'll be able to turn something around within the next couple of days. And it's not like we're, you know, can't get there for 5 weeks or 6 weeks and even accommodate those short-term huge bursts. And one thing, like I said, about the warehouse layout, we're able to pull resources from other areas. So if we get a huge burst in a specific area, we're able to just come in from our other local warehouses because we're not that far away and mm-hmm. satisfy that.
That's got to be nice to be able to sort of fill that gap then.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, from us at Ironheart, it's actually one of the perks of working for us because we have so much employee mobility and we allow our staff to, I mean, we try to have all our staff be very, very much the same level of expertise across the board. So if we have an operator crew from, let's say, Asheville, North Carolina, come up to Burlington, Vermont, they can just jump right in, provide the same level of quality that, you know, our customers in Burlington, Vermont are used to. But that also allows a really cool perk to all of our staff where they get to go to these hotbeds of craft beer and craft everything in all parts of the East Coast. And it's actually a really big perk for our staff, and a lot of them like it a lot.
So that happens where somebody will get that big grocery account, and more often than not, you'll be able to jump right in.
Regularly, yep.
About how much capacity do you guys have?
So this year, I think we're going to package, we're looking, in July, I know we packaged about 24,000 barrels in the month of July. So multiply that by 12, it was our busiest month, but we're probably going to settle somewhere around maybe 250,000 barrels, I think, this year. We operate roughly at around 70% capacity. Mm-hmm. So, you know, do the math. We're in the 300 plus thousand of capacity to be able to accommodate.
Is that a comfortable place to be?
Right now, yeah. It's been a little chaotic getting there.
Yeah.
But we do our best to stay ahead of the curve. Every year gets a little bit better for us. This was the first year that I think we were fully ahead of our curve. We really planned and built in a ton of extra capacity going into this year because we knew we were going to see spikes in those other verticals. Mm-hmm. So this year, we actually, even through our busy season, which is typically busiest months are April through July, we actually kept our entire company under 80% capacity the whole time, which means that, you know, it's great because we're able to keep our scheduling lead times low, satisfy all of our customers, keep employees' lives normal, you know, on a normal work week instead of chaos with jobs moving everywhere and a lot of long hours. So it's been a good time here this year. In mm-hmm. years past, you know, it's been a little bit more challenging as we've grown and as we've experienced demand bursts that we didn't think were coming. And all of a sudden, well, we're at, you know, 98% capacity and we were basically closing our doors for new business.
When you're running that tight, is it difficult to maintain customers?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah,
absolutely. I mean, it's difficult to maintain everything. It's difficult to maintain quality. It's difficult to maintain consistency. Equipment breaks down. You have less maintenance days. Obviously, you have really big hits to employee morale because we're working harder. We try our hardest not to work the weekends. But when you have a job Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, you don't have a down day for maintenance and kind of regroup. It's very stressful. You know, so we try really hard to maintain that, keep each canning line only running 4 days a week for a lot of reasons. But yeah, we definitely see customer turn in that because when that happens, our lead times inevitably get pushed out. And when they get pushed out too far, reduces the flexibility for our breweries. And rightfully so. If I'm a brewery, I'm like, I can't plan my production schedule out 4 weeks in advance to accommodate Ironheart. It's inevitably the nail in our coffin for losing them when we otherwise wouldn't have.
So is this, with 50 canning lines now, 23 warehouses, is this a comfortable place to be?
It's comfortable. I think because we've been able to put the right infrastructure in for it, we really planned for this level last year after we went through just a pretty rough summer and just honestly lead times went out real far. We did lose a lot of customers. We lost some key employees because it was pretty nuts. We made a really big effort over the last winter to plan. We've always kind of played catch up to the demand through the whole history of Ironheart since I started 6 years ago. This was the first year that we actually looked at it and said, okay, what's the building that we want? Let's build the building that we want to be. Let's look to the future and let's build where we want to go instead of allowing the demand to take us there and trying to play catch up. And so this was the first year that we actually did that. And it's probably been our most successful year.
So what is the building that you want to be?
Right now, it is where we are. And I think it's going to be a different building next year. And we're going to do the same exercise going into next year. And if this year we added about 12 candy lines to this point from January to now this year, which was basically right where we expected. Mm-hmm. We're adding a couple more permanent lines than we anticipated. But that's kind of less demand for us than normal mobile canning business. It's less impact to us. Is it going to be the same amount? Potentially. So are we going to add 10 or 12 more canning lines next year to get to maybe 60? Mid-60s, potentially. Yeah, I haven't necessarily got to that point yet.
Wow. What's the level of investment that you have to make in those type of lines?
Absolutely. I mean, each line is, you know, from a capital perspective, a couple hundred thousand. So we're a very capital intensive business. Mm-hmm. So it requires a lot of cash flow. And to this point, in all the 6 years of Ironheart, as much as we've done, we've reinvested every single dollar that we've made back into the business. We haven't taken any money out of the company. So everything has been invested back into the business, into growing, into our employees. We have a profit sharing program right now, which is fantastic. And so it takes a lot of money for us to grow.
Since it is sort of a rough schedule, you know, you mentioned 4 days on, you know, 1 day off, or not trying to work weekends. And you mentioned that last year you lost some key employees. How do you sort of work that work-life balance for your workers?
Yeah, it's a great question. It's something that we wrestle with all the time. And I would almost equate us more to like a hospital shifts, where we're, in all honesty, the nature of our business drives our work days being long. And we're on average probably 12 to 14 hour work days out there. You know, you think about where we try to keep drives under 2 hours from any given warehouse. So, you know, any given job, you could have an hour to an hour and a half drive time to the job. Hour to an hour and a half setup. So you're potentially 3 hours into a day before you even run a drop a beer through the canning line. And then when you're canning, even if it's only, you know, even if you're only running for 6 hours, there you go. 3 hours in the front, 3 hours in the back, 6 hours of canning. That's a 12-hour day. So we really try to balance it from a weekly perspective, and we staff to that point. And so our goals are always to staff all of our warehouses to the point where we're able to accommodate. And typically we try to shoot for like 4-day work weeks. Okay. And there might be people that they work 3 15-hour days. And they get a four-day weekend. And that does happen. We try to look at it from a more weekly overview perspective. Mm-hmm. When we do that and do it successfully, it is actually a perk to our staff, because you get longer weekends and you still get the same amount of hours that you'd be getting otherwise. And typically we're still getting overtime.
Do you think you've cracked the code on that?
It's always a work in progress.
Yeah.
We try really hard. We focus really hard on employee morale and how happy everybody is at Ironheart. Because in the old days, it was me out there running a canning line every day. It was, you know, the face of the company. And I saw all of our customers every single day. And the reality is now, the people who see our customers are our operators out there. They are the face of our company, not me anymore, not any of our other senior managers. It's our operators out there every day. They're the face of our company. It's very, very important. And so we've really made a big effort on morale events, team events. We launched a profit sharing program to reward people for the hard work that everybody's doing. So everybody's now a part of the company, which is really cool. So I think it's paid dividends. And, you know, it shows that we certainly care for our employees, and we put a lot of resources into our employees. And, you know, they certainly, all of our employee base is very committed, very dedicated. We try to show them how much we care in return.
Well, I want to shift gears a bit because Ironheart, like a lot of craft breweries and a lot of wholesalers out there, has been involved in a lot of M&A over the years.
Yep.
And that's really how you guys have sort of built your way down the East Coast and out into the South. So tell me a little bit about, you know, the deals that you've made, if you guys are still hungry for more.
Sure.
You know, where is Ironheart as far as M&A goes?
Yeah, absolutely. So over the years, like I said, Ironheart originally started, it was our original footprint was basically North Jersey through New England. And we made a decision that it was easier when we're looking at expanding, growing the business. There were other mobile canners. We all started generally around the same time, kind of absorbing that entire geography of what is now kind of the overall Ironheart. And it was a pretty tight network, you know, from that time. We all had been working with the company that started mobile canning in Denver, Colorado, Mobile Canning Colorado, and they started a company called CanSource, and they started an affiliation. We were all part of that affiliation originally, which was kind of just a network of us mobile canners out there. And it was good because we all kind of, we operated in our own area, and we didn't necessarily cross our borders, and we all shared resources and kind of shared expertise and knowledge and stories and things like that. So it was kind of a good brotherhood of businesses operating together, sharing best practices and things like that. And so we kind of had this network going already. And we made the decision that, okay, we're at a point where we want to start expanding. I brought on some partners to help me expand at that point. I actually took a year off at that point as well to regroup. But we made a decision as a company that instead of going out and competing and really, you know, when you have hard competition, it obviously doesn't necessarily do the best things for businesses. We made a decision that it would be best for ourselves, for our customers, to go out and basically acquire these companies, merge with them so we could operate more continuously through the geography, build more shared resources, do things like open a quality control department that's centralized to Ironheart. Now we offer lab testing. We have a tremendous amount of dissolved oxygen testing going on. So by kind of all getting together, we were able to have more dedicated centralized resources to a lot of things that we couldn't offer on our own and we couldn't afford on our own. And I think it's worked really well. So when we started this push, the first company that we acquired was the Buckeye Canning, which operated basically in Ohio area up through kind of Western Pennsylvania and then Western New York. And then we acquired Old Dominion Mobile Canning, which was Virginia and then kind of Eastern North Carolina. And then Land of the Sky Mobile Canning, which was Asheville based. So they basically covered the rest of North Carolina, South Carolina. And then Mobile Can Man, which was basically the rest of New York, and then followed by Toucan Canning, which was Tennessee, Georgia, Alabama, and then River City Canning, which was DC based. So that last piece of River City kind of got us that continual geography. And then from that point on, we really started focusing on, all right, now let's centralize some resources. We brought in all of our, you know, we have a quality control team up here in Manchester now. We have a whole engineering team up here in Manchester right now, all focused on making us better, offering things to our customers that we were never able to offer before, keep our quality higher. So it's worked out really well.
So are you looking to push further westward? Are you going to be moving into the Midwest or the, you know, further into like the Great Lakes or even down into the Texas region?
Yeah, it's a great question. One thing that we've realized is expansion is very difficult to leapfrog territories. And for us, expansion, how we work really well is kind of just pushing the borders of our existing network. And so we're able to kind of utilize existing areas and push them a little further and then open something new that already has a given set of business. So we actually experienced this in Florida. We were doing no business in Florida and we just went down there and opened in Florida without any business at all. It's been more difficult from that perspective because we didn't have any existing resources there. We're flying people in to go and you know, and train and make sure we're offering the same level of quality that we're offering everywhere else. And then also build a customer base when, you know, we might only have one canning run or no canning runs in a week, but we have to have a full-time staff down there. So it's been a little bit more of a challenge from that perspective of like opening a new area by kind of leapfrogging to other geographies. But to be honest, you know, over the last 4 years since we've been merging with the other mobile canning companies, it's been a major effort for us to get consistency. I mean, that's the biggest challenge by far. Even though we're all running the same kind of equipment, generally the same practices, be amazed at the level of differences that you can operate under and also approach to the business. So it's taken us a really long time and a lot of effort on my part and some of the other senior managers to get our level of consistency down and then bring that level of quality up. So we're offering that same level of basically delivery and quality everywhere in the company. That's what we've been exclusively focused on over the last 3 years. And so for us, we're getting to a point now where we're feeling pretty good. We still need a lot of work to do on that consistency and offer that same level of consistent high quality across the board. But we probably have not considered going further out because of that fact, because we're working so hard to contain ourselves internally to get ourselves consistent. And the thought of kind of going and leapfrogging into other areas hasn't really been part of our plan at this point.
Yeah, because I think for some people, there still remains a bit of a stigma on canning in general.
Sure.
And on top of that, I would imagine there's some stigma on mobile canning.
Yeah, there is. Absolutely. it's interesting that you say that, because when I first started Ironheart 6 years ago, it was immediately adopted as, okay, here is a company that's solely dedicated to quality and canning. And then a lot of people opened all over the country of all kinds of different operations, and some that I don't think were providing necessarily the greatest quality. And I think that it turned, and you were getting a lot of bad stigmas out there from mobile canning. You're not focused on dissolved oxygen. You're bringing dirty equipment. You're just throwing people out there and putting a bunch of beer down the drain. And so we've tried really, really hard to counteract that. We focus really hard. I mean, our goal is, we don't want to be the best mobile canner out there. We want to be the best canner, period, out there. We want to offer quality and expertise above what any brewery could do on their own. And that's really what our focus on. And I think we've done a good job, I think, of at least ourselves, of fighting that type of a stigma out there as mm-hmm. well. But, you know, from expanding the borders again, the one thing is we've never been needing to go out and get more business. We've always been trying to catch up to the business that's been there. So there's really no need for us to expand in order to grow. And we're honestly trying to just capture what's there within our current market now. So to grow on top of that, it would go against one of our, we have 10 commandments at Ironheart. It would go against our 10 commandments, which is our customers and the quality that we provide. And I think if we continued expanding, it would significantly dilute that.
We've heard a lot from the industry trade groups as far as the effects of aluminum tariffs
sure.
on craft brewers, brewers in general. And we don't hear a lot from, you know, how it's affected the mobile canning business,
right.
which you're dealing with aluminum cans. That's your business.
Yep.
So how have these tariffs affected your business?
To this point, it's been almost negligible, I would say. We really felt much. I mean, we've certainly had price increases, and yeah. we just do what any other pass-through business does. We pass the price increase through. Our breweries pass the price increase through. So any of these tariffs, all they do is affect the person buying the beer. Mm-hmm. And anybody in the beer industry is in an industry that's making very high margin products. I mean, we're not selling diamonds here. So we operate on very thin margins. So do our customers. And so we can't absorb any of that type of increase. So we have no choice but to pass it through. And same with our customers. And that's the funny thing about these increases is anything like this, any new tax, any new increase like this, it just goes right to the end consumer. It just hurts the guy buying the beer. And so that's been the biggest impact. It's when the first round came through, we probably saw about a 10% increase in the raw costs of cans. And like I said, it's passed through, but you're talking, it's going from, you know, 10 cents to 11 cents, mm-hmm. you know, a can. So it's not a tremendous impact. And there are bigger margins in craft beer. The people that are feeling it more are going to be the bigger producers that operate on much, much thinner margins. For us, you know, craft beer does, in the whole beer spectrum, operate on bigger margins than more of the larger breweries. So they're able to absorb it a little bit better. And then I think there is a little bit of, there's still been some price, I would say, acceptability from the consumer base, where a little bit of an increase where they're, instead of, you know, $16 for their four pack, they're paying $16.50 or $17. It's not really making them make a different decision. So I can't say that it's really impacted us much to this point, but who knows? You know, we're certainly seeing more of it coming through now.
Has it caused any type of shortages at all?
I don't think it's caused a shortage. I think the shortages have been more driven by the just demand in general on cans from everything.
Have you run into shortages?
Absolutely.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
How bad?
Last year, we almost ran out of 16-ounce cans last year. And various cans are harder to get. So for instance, 250 milliliter cans, which are the predominant package for wine cans, they are very, very difficult to get. And it definitely is impacting our ability to kind of to grow in wine with the difficulty in getting those cans. But 16-ounce cans, which are, you know, as you know, mm-hmm. probably the bigger choice for craft, especially the trendier craft breweries with cans, almost went completely out of stock last year. And fortunately, we have very diversified supplier network. So one of our suppliers starts running short, we're able to tap another supplier. And we've since increased this. But about this time last year, we were literally running out of cans. And as you said before, cans are our business. And yeah. if we run out of cans, we can't pay the bills to keep the lights on. So different than a brewery that, well, we don't have cans, I can just keg more. I have other options that I can go and sell my product. We don't have that. And we just don't work. And so it was a pretty close call for us last year.
So yeah, that's got to be a scary place to be in the middle of the summer.
Definitely. And since that point, we've actually built what we call Fort Knox now, because for us, cans are gold. And we actually built our own Fort Knox of cans that we keep right now, and rotating that stock, keeping that Fort Knox in. And I mean, as we grow 16 ounce cans, for instance, we at this point are going through as a company about 3 to 4 trailer loads of 16 ounce cans a week. So if you think about a shortage and how many cans we need to store in our Fort Knox to, let's say, if we were to try to bridge a gap of even a 2 week shortage on our end, we would need to have 8 to 10 trailer loads of 16 ounce cans in our possession to be able to bridge that gap. So it's a lot of cans.
Yeah. That's a lot of warehouse space.
Yeah. Yeah.
Where is Fort Knox?
Fort Knox right now is up in Manchester.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. Is it 16 ounce cans? Is that the can packaging type that you guys predominantly use at this point? Or is it still 12 ounce?
Yeah, it's a great question. It's certainly transformed over the course of our history. Right now, I think we're probably 60-ish% 16 ounce cans as a company. It's different in different regions. Up in New England, very much 16 ounce cans dominate mm-hmm. our landscape. But then you get down to like up our Southeast area, Richmond area, Virginia, much more driven in 12 ounce cans. So it really, and same with like Tennessee area, you know, it's really market driven. So in some places we're doing different things than other markets.
What do you see as the future for Ironheart? Is it staying on the East Coast and in the South and just adding canning lines and employees to service those in those markets? Is
sure.
it, you know, growing beyond that? Where do you want to be? Where's a comfortable place?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think our predominant focus right now is on achieving that level of consistency and quality that we want to achieve everywhere. Before we think about expanding borders, growing, we need to achieve a level of quality and consistency that's above where we are. It's a kind of our gold standard that we need to achieve, because we're never going to grow sustainably if we don't. And we're going to continue to lose customers. And so by us getting to that point, that will allow us to grow better. So I think that's focus number one at this point. And then really capturing these other market verticals that exist within our geography, because, and also I think fully tapping, Pierre, even though we've been around for 6 years and we're going to be doing, you know, 250 barrels or, you know, close to 70 million cans this year within our geography, I have to be honest, I'm still very excited about the amount of potential brewery business that there is within our geography. I don't think we need to go out of our geography to still grow in beer, which is a really cool thing. So I think, you know, the next focus would be just, you know, really capturing the market that we have available to us in our existing footprint. And first and foremost, it's just getting ourselves a sustainable business, sustainable for our growth, sustainable for our employees when we grow, our work-life balance when we grow, just making us a really good business, a great place to work for our staff, and a good place for everybody to come home to and be proud of. Our goal is building a business that can accept growth and do it in the right way.
We're going to wrap it up here, but any advice that you would give to somebody who either has an established business that's looking to can or, you know, is just starting out?
Absolutely. Focus on quality. I think it's so huge. And where the industry has gone, it just over the last couple of years since I started Ironheart, has gone, taken a really big shift to quality. And I think it's natural when you get in an environment that gets more competitive. Back when we started, it was still, you know, there was, like I said, roughly around 3,000 to 3,500 breweries when we started in the country. So it was much more of a brotherhood, everybody sharing information. And it's definitely gone away from that point. I mean, it's still very collegiate in the industry, but it's certainly more competitive right now and a lot more quality focused. And we see a lot of people opening right now. Where we see a lot of the problems is people not necessarily focusing on that quality. That's going to be the biggest thing going forward at this point.
Awesome. Well, yeah. Thank you so much for taking all the time, Tyler.
Absolutely. Thank you. Really appreciate you having me. This has been great.
Yeah. Cheers.
Cheers.
All right, that was our interview with Tyler Willey. Jess, you've got some firsthand experience with Ironheart from your time at Boston Beer.
I do. So in the last bit of my time at BBC, I was at the Sam Adams Brewery in Jamaica Plain, and we had started dabbling into specialty beer releases. And, you know, the first, well, I don't want to say it was the first, but one that got a lot of media attention was right after the Red Sox won the World Series in 2018. And we had a special beer. We named it Damage Done. We wanted to have a crowler release and make special labels for crowlers because that was, you know, what we had available. So what we didn't realize is that you can't really run a crowler like it's run for production. So It was a challenging week. Had some disappointed customers, a lot of sleepless nights for a lot of people on the team, a lot of overnight crowling, a lot of, you know, a lot of lessons were learned. So then...
That sounds a lot like what we've come to find out about the Red Sox since that year. A lot of damage done.
Yes. Yeah, definitely. I felt like that year, the whole of New England sports teams were almost personally out to get me for being probably the least sports interested person living in the six-state region. But that January, the Patriots then went to the Super Bowl and there was another special beer release, but we had learned some lessons. We knew we couldn't put our poor crowler through that again. So we set a limit on, I believe it was 199 crowlers of the special Tom Brady themed beer because that was his draft pick or the number that he was picked. Dude, I'm like the last person that should be allowed to discuss any of this. But we set the number at there'd be 199 crowlers. That was it. So we set expectations for consumers. That release party went much better, very smooth. We did have a long line, but everybody was happy to be there. We got some B-dubs ordered in. Everybody had some wings. Great time, great party. Then, as New England sports continued to apparently dominate in every sport, the Bruins went to the Stanley Cup. And before the series, we finally had gotten Tyler from, or one of Tyler's teams from Ironheart to come in and help us with a special beer for the Bruins. And instead of doing crowlers, we did four packs and it was so much easier. We were all really happy with how it went. It was a smashing success and all thanks to the homies over at Ironheart.
I don't know why I have it in my head, but it's always sort of surprising to hear that, you know, a major, major craft brewer like Boston Beer is relying on mobile canners. I guess you would just think that that would all be in-house, but as we've seen through their earnings and through everything that's sort of pulling down their gross margin, they're very reliant on different supply chain partners, you know, whether it's contract brewing or mobile canners or whatever it may be.
I mean, even when Jim started the company back in the 80s, he relied really heavily on contract brewing, and that was controversial at the time because nobody had really done it, but it just makes sense. Like if you don't need to make the capital investment into things like that, that frees up money for you to do other things like marketing and advertising. And I think that's really how Jim built Sam Adams.
And you got to think that there are a lot of small brewers too, who are rather than make that CapEx investment are just contracting with Ironheart.
Exactly. And I think, I mean, Ironheart is doing something that's like almost the, they're almost like the Zipcar of beer. Like it's, like the sharing economy is here to help you in your business. And what else? Like if you're too small to make the investment in a canning line, I mean, why would you spend all that money on a thing you use a couple times a month? But what else? What other services can be provided this way? Like maybe like lab assistants, stuff like that.
Yeah. Well, we could hope that that would be high on the priority list for a lot of breweries out there.
God, I sure hope so.
Yeah. But Tyler is really building a mini empire, it seems like. He's got, basically, you could, you know, cut straight down the U.S. map at this point and know where you can, you know, on east, where you can get a mobile canner.
Yeah, I mean, they're Maine to Florida, out to Ohio,
Michigan. And now into the Midwest.
Yeah, yeah, which is great.
Michigan, the Chicago area, Indiana. It's crazy how far and how much territory they've been able to gobble up. And you can only imagine that, you know, where does it stop? Mm-hmm. It's up
to
Tyler.
The Pacific Ocean.
The Pacific Ocean.
Manifest destiny.
Yeah. There we, I like that. That's awesome. Well, and one thing that Tyler really touched on too was it ain't easy being a mobile canner.
Oh, God, no. So those guys work really hard. So on the few Ironheart days at Sam Adams that I was around for, I used to think that I got to the brewery really early, but I would get there, I'd, you know, take like, I don't know, sometimes I would take like a 6:30 train down from Salem and they were already cranking away. And he's, you know, he described their day. It's like maybe an hour and a half drive to the site. And then when you get there, it's another hour and a half just to set up. So those guys are looking at 3 hours before they even get to do any of like the canning work. So sometimes like I'd roll up to the brewery and it would be 7:30 and they would already be cranking away canning. So those are long days. What he said, like 12, 14 hours.
Mm-hmm.
I'm tired thinking about it.
Yeah. So if you have a mobile canner and they come to your brewery, Be nice to them. Buy them a beer. Yeah.
Maybe get some pizza delivered.
Yeah. Take care of those guys out there.
I did like that he's doing those, looking at like, you know, 3 days, 3 days on, three 15-hour days. That's overtime right there.
That's a long week already in just 3 days. All right. That's our show for this week. Thank you for tuning in. We're available on every podcast platform imaginable. I don't have to tell you which ones they are because I'm sure you know what they are if you're listening to this already. If you enjoyed the show, leave us a rating and a review, share it with your friends and maybe some colleagues. Drop us a line at podcast@brewbound.com. That's podcast@brewbound.com. I'll respond at some point, I promise, probably a couple months later, but it'll happen. Thank you to our audio team. Thank you to our guest, Tyler Willey. Thank you to Jess and all our listeners out there. Catch us next week for another episode of the Brewbound Podcast. Until then, cheers.